I know it's the cup, and that it could be goals in it, but I'm thinking...
I know it's the cup, and I know there could be goals in it. You've really nailed your colours to the mast there, Steve. No, there might be goals.
There might be goals, but okay.
Are you Johnny Williams in disguise? Different week, same scoreline for Reading as they complete back-to-back 0-0 draws at Madejski Stadium with a stalemate against high-flying Burnley. We'll try and assess what we've learned from Saturday's latest draw and what our expectations should be between now and the end of the season. One team who had no trouble scoring goals was Reading's 106-point team 10 years ago, and one of our guests this week will give us a unique insight into his new book looking at what made that team tick. Plus, as always, we'll answer your questions in the mailbag and preview Saturday's FA Cup tie with West Brom. Hello and welcome to the Tireless End Podcast, episode number 85. My name is Dan Wimbush, editor of thetirelessend.com, and thank you very, very much for hitting that download button. Just before I introduce our guests, a very quick thank you to everyone who has joined in our crowdfunding campaign. It's very, very much appreciated. It's the reason why hopefully you hear us in a bit more clarity over the past few weeks, and we've been able to splash out on some new bits and pieces, but we still have got bits and pieces we'd like to improve on. So if you do want to join in, there is a link attached to this episode. But let's get on to our guest. First of all, let's welcome John Keane to the show. John, hello.
Hi.
Author of Some of the Parts and former Star board member, Football Supporters Federation board member. You've been there and done it all.
I have, yes, very much so, for about 40 years.
Absolutely. And he obviously writes for the Tireless End. You're one of our original writers. It's hard to believe it's now been 5 years.
Wow.
As you are as 1871, and the same on Twitter as well. So give him a follow there. And joining John on this week's show, it was due to be one Dave Handbags Harris, but he couldn't make it. A late injury or illness to one of his kids. And so I called up Westy saying, you know, Westy, we need you off the bench. He couldn't make it either. Johnny? No. No Johnny Williams. Who do we turn to in our hour of need? Of course, the one and only Mr. Steve Curtis, otherwise known as Raw Hoops. He is our Adam Lafondra. He's come off the bench to save the day again. Steve, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I've got you a winner.
You have. You have. You've stepped off that bench in real hour of need. We needed that last minute winner, and you've come through. So thanks very much for joining us. Gents, it's a strange sense of deja vu this week. I know neither of you were on the show last week, but I don't really think things have moved forward. Things have moved backwards. It's just a strange case of as you were. John, you've recently moved up to Scotland. How is it compared to Reading?
Different. The matches are very much more partisan. Even a minor match that doesn't count, the supporters hate each other.
Wow.
There's absolute vitriol when it doesn't matter at all.
I saw there was a Scottish Cup replay game recently. Was it Linlithgow and somebody else? And there was flares and all sorts, and the game had to be stopped. I was wow.
Yes, Celtic are the same wherever they go, so they'll always overreact.
Wow, okay.
Where do people get these flares from?
Especially green ones as well.
I don't know. There's always some sort of flare depository somewhere. But John, being up in Scotland, obviously you don't get to see every Reading game live, but in a way I think that gives you a more unique perspective, because when you do see it, you can see sort of the evolution of the team over time from when you do get a chance to visit. How have you looked at the progress of the team, certainly since Brian's come back?
I mean, it seems really what every sort of manager does when they come in and the team's not doing very well. First thing you do is tighten up the defence. So, you know, once you've stopped conceding goals, then you can concentrate on the rest. And I think it's that cycle that Brian's going through. Let's stop the goals going in at our end, then we can work out the midfield, then work out the attack. So really stages. And I think the big thing is that you said about Nearly's. We conceded against Ipswich late. All those ones that were going against us, they seem to be going down as well. So, yes, it is progress. I'm not sure it'll be quick enough progress for the Brian out brigade or the never wanted Brian here in the first place brigade. Mm. But it's definitely progress. But I mean, turning a football team around is like turning an oil tank around. You don't do it just like that.
Or Alex Pearce turning around. On that note, let's hit that recap. From the
Tarhurst end. Recapping this week's championship action.
So 0-0 with Burnley, Steve. As John said, sorting out the defence is the priority. They look to be on that right path now. back-to-back clean sheets. And Brian sort of was trying to show that as the positive in his post-match comments. He said after the game, when you're playing a top team like Burnley, it's got to be a point gained. The players showed real resilience, fighting for everything, going into every tackle. There were some great battles going on all over the pitch. No one was giving an inch. It's a real tough championship game. Once again, our players stood up to them and it could have gone either way. I'm proud of all our efforts today. We're inching towards where we want to get to. We showed the reliance I wanted to see, kept a clean sheet, and now we just need to add the goals to those clean sheets. Fair assessment for you?
Yeah, fair assessment. And he's done it before. When he was at Reading the first time, the main priority was getting the foundations of the defence sorted out first. And then from there, you know, he went forward and started improving the attack and midfield and stuff. And as John said, it is a case of build from the back, and it is a slow process. He's still figuring out who his best team is, really, who he can rely on and everything. And yeah, we are inching towards where we are, but that it is inching bit by bit.
Yeah, it's very slow. It's not exactly the dramatic rocket ship that you sometimes hope for when you get that new manager. But then I think sometimes you over-exaggerate. I can't think of too many managers that come in and immediately take a team up on a winning run. I mean, I was going to come on to it in a bit later, but if you look at the first 10 games of a lot of previous Reading managers, only one stands out for me for the first 10 games as having a remarkable start, and that was Steve Coppell, who won 6 of his first 10 games, picked up 19 points, but in the end that season they missed out on the playoffs anyway. Brian's got 10 points so far from his second spell. In his first spell he took 15. We've had Alan Pardew take exactly the same as Brian this time around. He took 10 points. Brendan Rodgers took 10 points. And Steve Clarke had 12. Nigel Adkins only picked up the 8, although it's a little bit unfair because he was in the Premier League. So, I mean, it shows that there's not a lot of dramatic starts there, John. And the thing that stands out for me, and it keeps standing, and Brian's even acknowledged it this week, is that once again, it's a tight game. Every single one of his games has been decided by less than a single goal. And that to me is a positive.
Definitely. I mean, those margins are so tight. But you were talking about Steve Coppell. He started well, but once he started to take control of the team, because he was doing things fairly slowly, then it dipped. 2 months into his tenure, there was a dire period of 3 consecutive 3-0 defeats. I remember Boxing Day, home to Wimbledon, who were rock bottom of everything, and we lost 3-0.
Didn't Joby get a goal that day?
I think he did, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, there's always a dip. It's good for a manager to get the dip out of the way at the start, but there will always be a dip.
Well, he's building foundations, and they often say that, you know, a good team starts with a good goalkeeper. That's been an area that Reading haven't exactly done well in this season. But credit to Ali Alhabsi. He was, you know, he's leading the man of the match vote. You gave him the joint highest rating of the team on Saturday as well, Steve, in your player ratings. Obviously, kept Reading in the game. He saved the penalty from Andre Gray that kept it 0-0. But first of all, the key talking point from both sets of fans is, was it actually a penalty? How did you see it?
Well, obviously you only see it once, and I haven't seen a replay since, really. But I didn't think it was a penalty. I don't know, the way the ball moved and the way Andre Gray kind of went down just hinted to me that there's something not quite right about that decision. But obviously in the end it doesn't really matter because he saved it, but it is... We see too much of it nowadays, I think. Too many players going to ground.
John, what about you? Because obviously you've only seen the television version, so...
Well, I mean, on Saturday from 400 miles away, I knew it wasn't a penalty. It just didn't look right. And the look on his face when he got up said it all.
Yeah.
You know, we've been conned.
It was more Ali Alhabsi for me, because I sit in Y25, I sat right opposite, and my first thing to it was, oh, that's a penalty. Because the way the play was developing, the way Alhabsi rushed out, I thought, there's no way he's not going to take him out. But as soon as you saw Alhabsi, so passionate in his reaction. Now, Alhabsi's a lot of things, but he's not somebody that tries to con the referee. We've very rarely seen him that animated, so he clearly felt passionate about it. And so did the Reading players as well. I mean, that's the other big talking point, especially from the Burnley side. And Sean Dyche, the Burnley manager, is not happy with Reading for this. A lot of delaying over the penalty. Hal Robson-Kanu kicks the ball off the spot and appears to scuff the penalty spot as well. Gray goes on to miss it. Good save from Alhabsi, who, it must be said, is a couple of yards off his line. Although that's not exactly something just restricted to Alhabsi. A lot of goalkeepers do it. But Johnny, are you happy to see Reading players doing little things like that, or does it leave a little bit of a bitter taste?
Not really. I mean, the margins are so tight, any advantage you can give yourself is worth doing. There were some things like this in the 106 season that haven't been terribly well publicised, but we were always trying to get any bit of advantage. And once you've got an incident like that and tempers are frayed, anything can happen. And that's what the game's all about, isn't it? It's passion. It's people doing things a bit different. That's what we want to see.
Well, that was the first and really only thing that got the Reading fans up for it on Saturday. I mean, it was about 17,000 the attendance, although there was never that many in the ground. It was just the Burnley fans did their best, but they weren't particularly loud. Reading fans are just so quiet at the moment, and it doesn't help that there's three or four empty seats between us all at the moment.
And there's not much to get excited about on the pitch, to be honest.
But that got everyone up. They followed about 10 minutes of, standing and singing and chanting, and Reading very nearly going up the other end and getting a goal. Brilliant counter-attack, some good work from Jan Kermigan. In the end, it falls to Hal Robson-Kanu. And you think, is this your time for glory? And he blazes it over the bar. For the first time since he left, I thought, I wish Nick Blackman had been on the end of that, because I would have fancied him to bury it. I fancied Hal to bury it, to be fair. Did you see it going in?
I thought he'd at least test the keeper when you see him go through it like that, because your immediate thought is, he's a forward, he's a professional footballer, you're one-on-one, you've got to at least hit the target. I'm not going to go in my Robson-Kanu rant, because I know we disagree on him.
Oh, come on, he's done well.
I think that summed up his game for me. I there was a lot of good bits, but they didn't end with good bits. Like, he'd get the ball and he'd wrestle a man off, and then he'd like kick it out of play or whip in an awful cross or something. We had this on our chat. We had a disagreement.
Absolutely. <there. laughs> Steve very much wanted to give him, he wanted to give him a 5 out of 10, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
That's not the only player rating that's upset the masses this week. The decision to give one Oliver Norwood a 4 has upset one fan in particular. Although a lot of people do seem to have agreed with you, to be fair, Steve. Yeah. I agree with you. So I didn't think Oliver Norwood was particularly effective today. John, how do you look at Oliver Norwood? Because he's a bit of a divisive midfielder.
He seems a bit one-dimensional. So if he's in his role, spraying the ball about, that's fine. But that seems to be all he does, really. I think the rest of the team isn't good enough to have the luxury of such a one-dimensional player. So I'd like to see him do more than he does.
Yeah, he very rarely takes a game by the scruff of the neck, does he? He doesn't produce that moment of magic out of nowhere to drag the team back into the game, or he's not got the sort of engine of a Carachan or a Sidwell. He's not got the real solid, you're not going to beat me sort of presence of a Parkinson or a Ledgerwood. He's just kind of sort of that 6-7 out of 10 player in a lot of areas. But
he has improved in that side of things this season. He is going in for challenges now, he is positioning himself a bit better, he is a good partner for Danny Williams. But this game, he gave far too many passes away, and has slowed play down and tried overcomplicated things when a simple pass would do. And I know Matt, and if you look in the comments section of the player ratings, he brings up all these stats and everything. But to me, what I saw with my eyes was a poor performance from one of our most important players, you would say.
And I think it's important as well to note that mark and how you view Norwood is based on what the good you've seen of him, because we've all seen him put in really great performances. I remember the 3-0 win over Fulham under Nigel Atkins a couple of years ago. He was magnificent that day. And sometimes early this season he's been great. The Ipswich game, fantastic performance, and got a goal as well. But it's because we know he's capable of so much better that when he fails to hit those heights, it's just the more disappointing.
Would it be too harsh on him to say he's got a touch of the Matioskas?
No, I don't think so.
I'm a big fan of Matioski.
He's a bit more reliable. I think he's got a bit more of an all-round game, especially defensively, than Matioski. But yeah, I think you're right, because especially in that, when you do play a four-man midfield. I mean, the thing about Sassi was he was given the role to be more influential because he had Michael Hector sat in front of the defence behind him. He wasn't sort of restricted and sort of, there wasn't that feeling that, I've got to stay back in front of the back four and defend it. He was given the licence to be more creative, especially because he had Stephen Quinn alongside him. He was really involved in quite a tussle with one Mr. Joseph Barton. And he just failed to impose himself. So, talking of Mr. Barton, he riled a load of Reading fans up. That will come as absolutely no surprise to anyone listening. Joey, not anyone's favourite player in the game.
But was that possibly why Norwood was so ineffective? Was he just psyched out of it and bullied off it?
I don't think so, because it was more Quinn dealing with Barton. I just think Norwood just seemed to struggle. I don't think he quite knew. It doesn't help him that he's not got a regular set of forwards around him or a regular, you know, he wasn't playing alongside a player he's played alongside a lot. But, I mean, Barton, the referee, Steve, just a really, really weak performance.
Yeah, I honestly, there were a couple of points where I just thought he's not going to get a card out today when you could easily have, you know, like six cards, maybe even a red or two. There's something, you know, you've got to take control of this game somehow. And there was no hint of, you know, any control to this game. He kind of let things run wild. And It was just not a good performance from him.
How do you rate the standard of reffing these days, John? A lot of people are saying the refs are getting worse. Do you see that?
I think they are, yes. I mean, they're under so much pressure and there aren't the kids coming through because, I mean, who would want to be a referee these days?
But the youngest referee in the league, wasn't he? 32?
Mm. I think part of the problem with refereeing is obviously we've got way more technology now and everyone can scrutinise decisions a lot more than they would have done, say, 20 years ago, because there just wasn't the chance to do that. So I don't know whether it is the referees getting worse or whether we just have more available to us to be able to judge them more.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the technology or the decision-making. It's the handling of games and handling of people and really, you know, having the cajones to get in there and assert yourself.
Well, and that's what he lacked on Saturday. He let Barton get away far too much, and by the time he tried to get control, and as I said, that's why you get instances like you saw with the penalty, because nobody was really respecting the referee. They sort of knew that he was letting everything go.
There's very little respect for referees nowadays anyway, at any level of the game, in any country really. It's all very much if we can get away with this, we'll try and get it from you, rather than, you know, rugby, for instance, you respect them. And
once you've lost a game, you've lost it.
Yeah.
You're not getting it back.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there was a little incident towards half-time as well. I've seen the video footage back. Barton and Quinn going at it as they sort of verbally as they get towards the tunnel. And Barton's a pro. Barton knows what he's doing. Mm. There was a little shove from him on Quinn into the tunnel. And obviously, that's where the video footage stops. Mm. Now, there was a call into BBC Radio Berwickshire that said it did kick off in the tunnel. Obviously, nobody's said anything about that. Players are smart, that neither of them want to get themselves a ban. And the referee probably doesn't want to deal with it either. So, but, you know, love him or hate him, he knows what he's doing at this level. And that's the type of player you kind of need in your side. He's got previous teams up, and I'm sure, especially looking at Burnley, because I thought they were a very, very good side. That we were lucky that, as well as missing the penalty, Andre Gray missed two absolute sitters as well. But I think they'll be there and thereabouts. Just before we move on, though, let's look at some of the positives. We mentioned Al Habsi having a good game. Others coming in for some praise. Paul McShane, good day for him. Really solid performance in the captain.
Yeah, he's very calm, very composed. He organises the defence well. He seems able to catch up with people, which I don't know, that surprises me, seeing a defender catching up or at least positioning himself in a way to be able to...
Little bit of the Inge Marson about him sometimes. That Inge Marson had that ability to sometimes just get the right side, and his positioning and reading of the game was so good that he could get himself out of trouble as well. I do see him as that sort of a defender.
Yeah, because Inge Marson was always underrated by everybody, but the pros loved him and knew what he could do.
Absolutely. And Jan Kermigan as well. I mentioned he sort of teed up one of Reading's best chances of the game. He also hit the post as well with a header. We're slowly seeing the best of him, but do you think he's going to be there before the end of the season?
I think so. I think this was actually a fairly good performance from him, bearing in mind he didn't get much of a chance to shoot a goal or anything. But I think playing that one man up front role was difficult, and he won his fair share of headers. You know, he won a lot in the air, and there was just no one around him to pick up those headers he did win. And so if he's there just for people to rotate around and pass off, then he did what he did, but he wasn't close to scoring apart from that header. But you'd think, you know, if Vidra comes back, or maybe if Raquel's gets a couple of chances to start next to him, you'd hope that he looks like the perfect kind of two-man strike partnership player. But on his own up front, you can't see him doing too much other than just winning the ball and playing as a, you know, back-to-goal type man.
You did feel very, very sorry for him, stuck there. He was winning a lot of flick-ons and just having no support. Lucas Pearson, as I tweeted around half-time, he showed about as much strength as a Smart Price paper towel that had been in the bath for half an hour. Just so weak. He's clearly got some skill. He's scored some decent goals this year and he's made some good passes, but he's just not a Championship player, John.
Yeah, I mean, from what I've seen of him, I'll agree. He just looks lightweight.
Yeah.
I think that is part of a problem, is kind of, especially in the Championship, you expect players to be able to at least put up a fight or hold off a man. I think part of the problem is he hasn't got any outstanding physical attributes. You know, he's not very quick. He's not very strong. He's not good in the air. And if all he does is pass, you need to give him the ball to his feet. And I think too many players are expecting him to make that run in behind or something.
He plays a free role. He just seems to play the free role wherever he's not needed. Yeah. He seems to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, anyway, it is another draw. It's two draws, two clean sheets on the trot. Although it's, what, 3 wins in 19 now? Not looking very good. The league table as it is, Reading are 15th as we record this. You know, they've picked up 37 points. They're on course to get that 50-point mark. John, I've asked everybody in recent weeks, I will ask you, are you at all worried about the teams behind you?
This season, no, not at all. They're not going to go down. I just can't see that happening.
Good. Good, we're in agreement. Steve?
Yeah no, it's not going to happen.
Thank you very much. Reading on 37 points. Rotherham under one, Mr. Neil Warnock, who we'll be seeing a week tomorrow. They are the team third from bottom on 26 points. Charlton are on 25, Bolton on 24. So Reading 11 points away from Rotherham. And, you know, to put that into context, Rotherham, just to pick up those 11 points, would be looking at nearly half their points total again in only a third of the games left of the season. So sort of puts into context, I think we're so used to chasing playoffs where every point really matters that you just don't realise that you don't need to do a lot to get to that 50 points. Yeah. It's like 3 or 4 wins. And even in the form we're in, you know, we're going to pick those up. So that's how it stands. If you are still dreaming of a playoff place, please keep dreaming and I'll have some of what you're having. We're 14 points now away from Derby, who I know are now 8 games without a win. They sacked their manager, Paul Clement, and Nick Blackman has now been relegated to unused sub.
He's a typical Reading player, isn't he? He looks great at Reading, gets sold and doesn't really go on to do very much.
I would like to raise a glass at this point to one Nicky Hammond again for another fantastic piece of transfer work. Well done, Nick.
I mean, Derby, £2.5 million is a lot of money to spend just to blow your playoff chances.
3.5, wasn't it? Three and a half. Close to 4. I think Charles said it could even be 4.
Yeah, I think there's so many add-ons. Yeah. And it gets so complicated. From what I understand, it was 2.5 basic, but it could go up a lot. But it's not going to.
£250,000 would seem a lot of the form he's in at the moment. Anyway, that just about wraps up the recap. We'll move on now to some news bites.
Reading News Bites on the Tarlhurst End podcast.
So on the news front, not a lot to report this week. The major note to point out is that Aaron Tischbowl has had successful hamstring surgery. He posted a nice picture on Instagram from his hospital bed, giving a thumbs up. But doesn't look like we're going to see him again this season. But given the way the year's panned out, I don't think there's any rush unless maybe he's going to try and get himself fit for that inevitable FA Cup final appearance, Steve.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great, wouldn't it? Yeah. End up on the bench, maybe.
No way. Starting.
No, starting.
He's going to start in our winning FA Cup final team. So best of luck, Tish. Obviously, he's had a fantastic season so far. Real shame that he's caught up with injury, but he's still so young that I think some people were saying, trying to write him off as a Karachan already, and I'm like, well, come on. He's only 20. It's the first injury. It's not exactly like he's in his mid-20s like Jem was. Mm. Besieged by them, so cut some slack, people. Speaking of youngsters, a couple have gone out on loan. Jake Shepherd has gone to Eastbourne and Liam Kelly has gone to Bath. You might remember both of them from scoring absolute screamers at the academy level, especially Liam Kelly's free kick did all the rounds on social media. Got on Soccer AM, I think.
Yeah, Liam Kelly was very highly rated a couple of years ago. I thought he would have gone somewhere higher up than Bath. You know, I thought he would have gone to maybe a League Two side.
Isn't he quite a small player though?
Maybe. He might suffer from the cool.
I think physically he's not the best. I can't remember, but I seem to remember it height-wise, he's not very big. And obviously that doesn't do Lionel Messi any harm, but it can sometimes hold you back in midfield a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see how he copes on loan. Just because you mentioned cool there, Steve. John, you actually saw Aaron Cool play for Dundee United out on loan this season. Now, he's not featured since he's come back for Reading, and a few fans are asking what sort of happened to him. How did you rate his development when you got to see him?
Embarrassing, to be honest.
Oh, I mean, dear.
He was playing in the role that Michael Hector's playing now, so in front of the back four. Oh, yeah. And he's not that sort of player. No. You could see him trying to thread passes through, but Hibs massacred Dundee United. Not by goals, but in terms of play. And he just looked like a completely lost sheep. And I think he'd been playing that all season. So I don't know what damage that's done to him, but he was so out of position and looked so lost. It's just not his role at all.
Yeah, it's a rush. I know he's doing quite well for the under-21s this season. The last time I saw him play a first-team game was at Brentford, and unfortunately he had a mare that day as well. He sort of gave away one of the goals, effectively, with a slip. It's just not quite working out for him. And there's a few of those players that have been sort of around the first team under Nigel Atkins when we needed them, and you had really high hopes, but they've just not kicked on. You at all worried about Cole?
Well, I think at this stage it's difficult not to be a little bit worried, because obviously he broke into the side under Atkins and then went on loan, and you thought, great, he'll get some first team games, and then that didn't go to plan, and he's come back and he hasn't gone back on loan. He's kind of just back in the under 21s. So you wonder, maybe this is a tactic, you know, get his mind in the right place, give him some confidence boosting under 21 time, and then send him back on loan somewhere where they'll play him in his correct position and some support around him.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll have to see how it goes. A lot of young players have gone out on loan this year and not done brilliantly. Tariq Fossey went to Fleetwood. He's come back. He's in a very similar situation to Cole at the moment, where he's back with under 21s. Although it was interesting, I was listening to something that Jurgen Klopp was saying in a press conference recently, and he was talking about how he wanted all of his players back at Liverpool because he wants to get them into the mix, into the mentality. And I do wonder, I know we've just sort of said these two, a lot of younger players have gone out on loan, but it's interesting how there's only a couple of them out. Brian does seem to be keeping a lot more of them in. Do you think that's a deliberate ploy?
Quite possibly, yes. Once we're safe, I'd imagine we'll see more of them. Because, I mean, to me, the problem, I mean, certainly with Cole and some of the other kids who've started playing quite young in the first team, they're not streetwise. So, I mean, up against the likes of Barton, but up against any standard championship long-term professional, they'll get suckered so much into giving away silly fouls and so on. It's really the nous that you get from playing games is what they need to get.
Yeah, I didn't mention it in the recap as well, Steve, but Jake Cooper will probably have learned a very valuable lesson. He tried to do a little bit of a mazy dribble and got horribly caught out.
Yes.
His skipper bailed him out, though.
Yes, he did, yeah. I like Jake Cooper. I think the more I see him, the more I like him. But yeah, he made a terrible... I think he did it twice, didn't he? Or he gave it all away twice. And I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that he hasn't gone out on loan, so he is learning as he goes along.
There's certainly smoke to those fires, John, of Premier League teams looking at him. You could see why there's certainly interest, even if there were no bids made.
Definitely, yes. I mean, he's obviously got potential, but he can't realise it until he gets the games.
Exactly, and then he's getting just that, so it's nice to see. Right, time now for us to move on to a little bit of pub chat.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast. By Reading fans, for Reading fans.
Right, I know I did promise a pub chat last week from one of our mailbag questions looking at which five Reading players we would build a side around. I've put that to one side again this week, so apologies. I can't remember who requested it now. I haven't got my show notes from last week, but I do apologise. That will be next week's pub chat topic. The reason for the change is because John has made a visit down from Scotland, and it would be amiss completely not to take this opportunity to quiz him about a book that I can't wait to read. John, it's called The Sum of the Parts. The basic premise is looking at how the 106 team came together. It's not just a simple story of what happened that season. It's a look at what made that team tick and how it all came about. But I'm sure you can explain it much better than I do. How did the whole idea for the book come about, and how is it coming together?
I mean, basically, when Steve Coppell left, that was the day that I thought I had to write this book one day. It's really the book I was destined to write, because I was involved with Star then. I hosted a few fans forums, went to the senior management meeting, so I've got a bit of insight into what was going on at the club over the three seasons in question, really. That's the 106 season, the eighth place in the Premier League, and then relegation. I then went and spoke to an assortment of people. I've not really gone for the players. I've gone for the people behind the scenes. So, I mean, Ron Grant, for instance, a kit man who was in the dressing room, has given me some brilliant insight. And really, I've discovered the story doesn't start with Steve Coppell. It starts before then.
Where does it go back to? What's the turning point for you? What have you picked out as the real birth of this?
I mean, the birth was John Medeski in the Mad Stad, and that was one of the foundations. It's like, I mean, I'm a historian, and one of the things that I love history-wise, is the Industrial Revolution. That was only going to happen if about 12 things all happened at the same time, and they happened to, and boom, it exploded. And the growth of that Reading team was exactly the same. You had to have a number of factors, and they all came at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, for the season, with every year that passes and every year it gets further away, the achievement just seems more and more remarkable. With every year that we don't do the same, I mean, every season starts the same, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. You get a couple of wins on the board and someone starts saying, oh, we're only X points off the pace of the 106 team. And the same, I know on Hobnob there's like a 106 point watch. And nobody comes close.
And it's the style they did it in as well.
Yeah.
I mean, there was just so phenomenal. I mean, I discovered the X factor, and it's...
You tell Brian McDermott, please?
Brian McDermott...
He might take your call if you tell him.
He knows. Whether it can be afforded is another matter. Because
there
were some outside people involved in the club who I think were the ones who tied it all together and sprinkled the fairy dust.
Can you give us a hint as to who that might be? Or are we going to have to buy the book? I've already pre-ordered it, so you can tell me. It's not like anyone else is listening. It's only me and Steve. This isn't a podcast or anything.
I mean, basically they were a team of performance consultants who came in, and some people have heard of them. People probably remember Bring It On.
No.
Against the Norwich.
Our listeners out there are nodding away.
Yes, yeah. Placards with Bring It On being held up at the start of the match. It was home to Norwich at the end of January 10 years ago. So 10 years and a week ago, something like that.
Yeah, it is vaguely ringing bells.
And lots of people hated that because they thought it's the club trying to motivate. That was one of the ideas that came from these performance consultants, and that was purely based on the team. But, I mean, effectively, it was the way they motivated the team, the way they taught Steve Koppel to be that much more effective in the way he communicated and managed. It's a really interesting story, and I think I've got some insight on it, definitely. And
so if we started holding up these placards again, would that...
Bring it on again.
Yeah.
Not really. There's a whole lot more to it than that.
Okay. The more you've delved into it, obviously, you say it was lots of different things coming together to make that team happen. How much of it is down to individuals within that 106 team compared to the way they were prepared and the coaching staff and things like that? Has your views shifted as to the responsibility?
Yes. I mean, Wally Downs, I thought he was just a coach, but Wally Downs, having met him in a pub, is brilliant. And I mean, what he actually did to the defence. I mean, the defence, we had no sendings off all season. The back four had something like 8 yellow cards between them all season. It was just incredible how stable they were. But rather than individual people, it was the mix, I think. The mix was absolutely perfect. So where there were deficiencies somewhere, somebody else would make it up.
Do you think luck played any part of it? I mean, a lot of people say that, oh, well, we had such a small squad and we got away with only having a couple of injuries. You just look at the injuries we've had in the last couple of seasons. The treatment room's been bursting at the scene. I'm sure they've had to expand it. Over the last year or so, was there any luck to it, or was that part of it, the fact that the injury record stayed so good?
A bit of both, really. I mean, the Burnley game, towards the start of the season, we had 3 players injured, Sidwell, Kitson, and I think Shorey.
Remember Doyle coming on to score the winner, didn't he?
That's right, and we brought 3 of the fringe players on. I mean, Chris Makin came in and played 8 games, and it was indistinguishable, so... The whole squad was there, even though it was a small, tight squad. Everybody stepped up. I mean, John Halls, who we bought from Stoke, played 1 game, scored.
Former guest on this podcast, and now model, John Halls.
Oh, really?
Wow. He is now a model. Yeah, go back and listen to it. I think it's, we're not on 85 now. It's probably the best part of 45 episodes ago. But yeah, he's a model now, so after his playing days ended. It was such a fantastic team. The other obvious question to ask you is then, it all went so right for so long. How did it then go so badly wrong? How did it go from a 106 side, then finished 8th in the Premier League, to getting relegated the next season, and then obviously to where we are today?
I mean, really, those crucial success factors, some of them just evaporated, and it started to crumble from there. I mean, I'm just writing those bits now. It's the final chapters. It's a bit slow to write because it's not so nice to write.
I was
going to
say, it must be really sad.
It is, yes. Although, I mean, writing the championship winning section and the bit about Leicester and the aftermath of Leicester. I had tears in my eyes just remembering it. It was so emotional. But things really started to crumble. The performance consultants moved on. I mean, it's not a direct result. It's not. There was a lot more to it than that, but it's all the little things that have been put in place. They didn't just crumble, they eroded. And, you know, 99% is not as good as 100%, and you needed 100% for it all to click together. So it was lots of little factors, but that's the chapters I'm on at the moment, the last couple of chapters, to analyse where it went wrong as well.
Could it happen again? You said that Ryan knows what the X factor is to get it to happen again. Has football changed fundamentally in those 10 years? Obviously, we've seen things like the Elite Player Performance Plan come in, we've seen financial fair play, we've seen more and more money come into the Premier League, and then by effect, parachute payments. You know, back in the day, there were 2 years, now we're talking 4 year cycles. It's hard to believe Reading are still picking up best part of £15 million a year from the Premier League. We've been out of it for 3 years. So, is it possible for a team like Reading to put that sort of team together again in the modern climate, or has just football moved on?
It's possible, but it'll be difficult, because what the performance consultants were doing really was 10 years ahead of its time, 10 years ago. So really the sort of thing they're doing, everybody's doing now. So it's, we've lost that competitive advantage. I mean, getting the right team and the mix, I mean, it could happen, but, you know, finding Doyle and Long for £100,000 is, that's not going to happen every 10 years.
Yeah, we tried. Carl Shepherd and Dave Mooney didn't quite live up to the and poor Brett Williams. Yeah. Not quite there, but you never know.
Yeah, although I believe Moody was really a present to Cork to try and keep them in business and as a reward for selling us those two. Because, I mean, we paid a fair price at the time, but when you look back...
They went bust, didn't they?
Oh, they've gone bust a few times.
Shame. Mm. Yeah, real shame.
There's a massive appetite for football in Ireland, but it's English football and European football. Nobody goes to the local matches, which is a real shame.
Okay, so before we move on then, key thing here is when can we expect to see the book? How is it coming along? And more importantly, how can people get involved and help you out with it?
Right, the publication date is the 19th of March. That's just about set in stone now, and it will be on sale at the Megastore. I'm hoping to be launching it that day at the Cardiff match, which is the closest Saturday to the anniversary of promotion, because the fixture computer has given us a week off just on the anniversary of promotion, which is a shame. Mm. But I'm still selling subscriptions, which is somebody to be involved in the book and to have their name in it to show that they're supporting it. I think I've got 37 of those left at the last count, and people can pre-order from my website. So either of those, it's micklepress.com, which is micklepress.com.
And where, I know there's a Facebook page as well. What's that called?
Oh, that's a good question.
We will put it on the link that goes out with this article. We'll link to the website and to the Facebook group. Obviously, you're on Twitter at URs1871 yep. as well. So if you've got any questions about it, just give John a nudge. I'm sure he'll get back to you in quick time. I said it is a fantastic project, and you do really, I said Steve, you really appreciate that side the more it's gone.
You really do. You know, I mean, you look at the past few seasons, and it really does make you look back, and kind of nostalgia sets in, and you get really quite emotional about it. And I think just seeing John talk about it, getting this passion and everything, it's really exciting. I'm looking forward to the book.
Did you get a chance to speak to Sir John?
Oh, yes. In fact, an absolutely surreal moment. I was in Sir John's flat interviewing him and drinking coffee. The phone rang halfway through the interview. Sir John went and got it and said, "It's Nick Hammond for you."
Oh, dear. So, yeah. Did you suddenly see some armed guards appear at the door?
No, I mean, that was fine. It was just to rearrange an interview with Nick Hammond. But it was surreal just to be phoned up when in John Majewski's flat.
Yeah, the only people that usually get called like that are Jacob South-Klein on transfer deadline day for Bushwatch. So, as I said, fantastic project. We will put all of the links in the website article, and I said, do get in touch with John. The book's called The Sum of the Parts, and hopefully, as John said, it'll be out in about 6 weeks from now. So good little present if you're getting a bit bored at some of the action. You open the book up and read it. I know there's been certain times in the last few games where I've wished I've had a good book. So yeah. I will certainly be tracking that down. I've got my pre-order in. Can't wait for that. So, John, I said, you're still with us. I'm not going to thank you. I mean, you can go if you want to. I mean, I sometimes hold people here against their will. But not this time. We'll keep you with us. But thanks for explaining more on the book. In the meantime, it's time for us to move on to the mailbag.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at The Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/ The Tarlhurst End.
Mailbag time then. And thanks very much to everyone who has got in touch using at The Tarlhurst End on Twitter, facebook.com/ The Tarlhurst End, and our email address, thetarlhurstend@gmail.com. We start with Matt Castle, who writes our championship roundup and did get into that very heated argument about your Oliver Norwood form. But you see, we're not hating on it. We will read out your email. He sends a message. Do you think the referees need to be made more accountable for their mistakes? I understand that it's a difficult job, but they have set rules on how to judge incidents, and yet the referees are making far too many mistakes. Joe Barton should have picked up at least 4 yellows before he even got booked, and Andre Gray's kick out of Obisa was seen but unpunished. Also think that refs should be made to explain their decisions afterwards and apologise for their mistakes. John, is there enough accountability for the officials at the moment?
There's accountability, definitely, because there's the match assessors and reports from both teams. There's not public accountability, and I'm not sure that's a good idea, because, I mean, the job's hard enough already and there's few enough quality refs coming through. That would just put them off even more, I think.
I think, as you say, if you put them in the public eye and get them to come out and start explaining everything, I mean, A, post-match would go on forever, and B, you would put a fair amount of people off, because they're only there to referee the game. You know, they're not there to speak to the press and explain everything. And sometimes they don't have an explanation, it's just they saw it and they felt that was the right thing to do, and they get boring after a while. I felt it was the right thing to do.
I mean, it's a tough one, but it would like to be occasionally just to have a report out, or the referee's assessor come out and say, this is the reasons why. I spoke to him about it. I know that, I mean, they do sometimes apologise. I remember that one sent an apology to Brian McDermott a couple of years ago. Was it Nigel? It was Nigel Adkins, actually. Do you remember when Chris Gunter got taken out in the box at Blackburn and he got an apology from the referee afterwards, after the ref had gone back and seen it? So it does happen, but in the heat of the moment, they have a very difficult job. I know the referees in the Premier League are professional now, and that's obviously for them. If they do make mistakes, and like you say, John, they get assessed, and if they get too many bad marks, they're off, and that's their livelihood gone suddenly all of a sudden. So there is a lot of pressure on them. And like you say as well, it's the more people hammer referees, the less people want to become referees.
Yeah, and also, I mean, if a ref comes out and says, yes, I was wrong, he's got no authority for the next game at all.
Very true. Very true. I suppose it's just an experience thing. We mentioned the referee on Saturday was the youngest we've had in the championship this season. So hopefully he'll learn, and the more he gets experience, he'll know how to deal with cunning players like Barton. And mentioning Barton, Nick Beckett said, Sean Dyche wouldn't condone his players reacting like Hal Robson-Kanu when the penalty was given. Presumably then he's quite happy condoning Joe Barton pushing Quinn down the stairs at halftime. We mentioned that. I'm sure Dyche isn't happy at some of Barton's Atlantics, but he realises how effective it is. And sometimes you just need that player.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to publicly condemn him, because he'll, I mean, can anybody control Barton?
No.
He's a force of nature, really, so why worry?
Absolutely not. He's the Kanye West of football. Let's get in that one pop culture reference, so we're not completely behind the times, Steve. Still down. Still down with it. Still down with social media. You are our social media guru, so...
Yeah, which you gave me. Didn't I give it to myself?
I think you gave it to yourself, yeah.
That was an error.
Steve puts together our tweets of the week. Always one of the most entertaining parts of... I say that completely unbiased. It's always a good read. I'm just saying that to put pressure on him to keep it up. So there you go. It's that motivation for you. Right, Ben Prince says, would you welcome an NFL-style challenge flag for managers to dispute contentious decisions? For example, Gray's dive.
I don't know how the NFL-style challenge flag works.
Well, basically, they have a certain amount of challenges. They can throw a flag on the field. The player then gets reviewed, and it either gets overturned and they lose a challenge. It's similar to cricket, really. Or if they're wrong, they lose a challenge. I think they lose a timeout as well. So basically, they have a certain amount of challenges to make. But it's a bit easier with NFL because plays stop and start, whereas an incident can happen in a football game and then five... down the road a player goes and scores a goal. So for me, I would like to see it, but I don't know how you implement it without really stopping the flow of the game, John.
Absolutely not. Anything that stops the game is terrible. I mean, technology that supports decisions like goal line technology, perfect. But anything that stops the game and potentially rewinds it, absolutely not. I mean, there's so many reasons why not.
Well, the thing is as well, is to think about things like that. I mean, I've seen the replay. I've seen it, you know, probably about 10 times. I can't make my mind up. Now, unless you spend the money getting 15 different camera angles and take that time to see it, and a lot of things are down to opinion as well.
This is, I mean, things like handballs where there's intent to be judged. It's all the context. Nobody in a studio, no matter how many camera angles they're going to get, is going to be able to judge it accurately compared with somebody actually close to the player seeing it. So I think it's a complete non-starter, and it would change the game irreparably.
Yeah, I mean, it keeps it entertaining, doesn't it? All this controversy. You keep it all, oh, was it, wasn't it? And it keeps people talking for days, and, you know, we're talking about it now, days after. So
I mean, goal line technology has been a great thing, and the way that it's instant and it's 100% accurate, I think that's fine, and that is something that's cut and dry. But for things like, especially with the modern offside law and fouls and interpretations, things like that, it's just just give the referees the best training they can, make sure they're as fit as they possibly can. And at the end of the day, just accept that it's part of the game we love, that there are going to be these moments.
Because, so, I mean, yes, they'll make mistakes, but they won't deliberately make mistakes.
No. Right, very much hope not.
Yeah.
Very much hope not. No. Right. Chris Hartley, the Burnley game, I think, showed how much we missed Vidra. Kermigan had no one chase his flick-ons, but we hung tough against a tough side. Very much agree.
I agree. It's a funny one because you'd imagine if you brought in Vidra, say he was available, then you would have dropped either Quinn or Hector, you'd say. And then you'd miss Hector being the anchor and breaking up play, or you'd miss Quinn going toe-to-toe with Barton. I guess it's all part of the balance of the play type thing. But I would say, yeah, I mean, we've said since Kermigan joined that he looks like the perfect foil for Vidra. And I think Saturday did show, yeah, you know, you can see it there without Vidra. That's kind of what we're missing.
John, would you invest a lot of time in a Vidra-Kermigan partnership, given that obviously Matty's only got another, best part of 15 games left at the club, and Kermigan can't even play in the FA Cup? So,
well, I mean, if you're talking about the future, perhaps we ought to be playing Dominic Samuels. Mm. I mean,
scored again on Saturday.
Exactly, yeah. Let's do what we can this season. And then, I mean, who knows who's going to be here next season?
Yeah, they agree in general, though, Chris. It was a good point against a tough Burnley side. Joseph says, can you discuss whether 4-4-2 actually works at all? Don't remember us dominating a game this season playing that formation.
Leicester? They're playing 4-4-2 pretty much every game, and they're top of the Prem. So, yeah, it does work, and you see the 106-point season, we played 4-4-2.
Except for one game. In the very first match against Plymouth, we switched to 4-5-1.
And that we all know how that one panned
exactly,
out.
Yeah.
I think obviously you do have the concern that you get outnumbered in midfield nowadays, but you do look across the top tier divisions and there are teams, you know, we mentioned Leicester, but you also think Watford, they're doing it, and Villarreal are doing 4-4-2, Atletico Madrid 4-4-2. It does work, it just depends how you set it up.
And it's a case of the personnel as well. I know Bucks Royal put out his best Reading 11 a few weeks ago, and I think that was mapped out in a 4-4-2. But Brian just hasn't had the players. He's not had all of the squad available and fit at his disposal to go, this is how I want to build a side. He's not had the training time either. Every week it seems he's got a midweek fixture to deal with, so he's not had those players on the training ground to start building what he keeps talking about, that identity, to get that team playing in a certain way. And it doesn't matter what formation he picks at the moment, because every week he's dealing with more injuries. I mean, how are you supposed to build any sort of continuity? Obviously, we'd like to see better results, but I do feel very sorry for him. Not that'll probably, as you mentioned right at the top of the show, John, that probably won't keep the McDermott out.
Well, quite, yes.
And we did have a request from one of our followers to come on the show to explain why he saved McDermott out. And I did say to him, you know, try and send in a voice clip and we'd play it. But to his credit, and fair enough, he said to us, well, then I couldn't respond to how you respond to me. So might get him on at the end of the season. But I'm still disappointed that we're talking 10 games into a manager's reign and people are saying,
yeah,
get him out.
He said, was it, is it post-match or pre-match recently, he's been almost begging for time, you know, saying things are going to take time, I haven't had time to train them. And you think, he's only just got here, why has he got so much pressure on him already? It's ridiculous.
I think the people who are saying McDermott out are the people who didn't want him to come back in the first place. So that they're not going to cut him any slack or give him any time at all.
Until things get good, and then they'll back him, and oh, fickle.
Ooh. Sorry. Say it how you mean it. Right, moving on. Stuart, do we overestimate how good our players are? Many who leave hardly play again, for example, Federici, Pierce and Karachan. Now, I'm writing a piece on the academy right now, and one of the points I'm going to make in it, it's a good point to point out, our State of Reading FC series, which you can read on the Tarlhurst End all of this week, started with talking about identity, which we'll put out today, so keep an eye on that. Anyway, back to this. I'm writing a piece on the academy, and there is that thing that not many Reading players that have left us do go on to cut it at Premier League level. John, do you think we do overrate some of our players?
I'm not sure. I mean, we've got the brilliant ability to get lots of money for players who are past their best. I mean, Songo and Kitson being sold on the same day for the sums we got from them was just bite their hands off time. Mm. I don't know. I mean, there's Antonio, who was a really good prospect, but because of where we were at the time, we couldn't develop him, we couldn't give him games. So we did the fair thing to him and let him go out and develop his career elsewhere, and he's made a success of it. So it's difficult to tell. I mean, we seem to do pretty well. I mean, Gilfy is an example that where he was always going to outgrow us pretty quickly.
Yeah. And you pick the ones you've picked out for leaving. I mean, Federici was always... He's getting towards the later stage of his career. He's not old, especially for a goalkeeper, but we sort of knew he'd roughly found himself. After all, he was dropped for Alex McCarthy, who himself can't get in a team. So I don't know if we overestimate players. I don't think there were times in each of those players' careers where we thought they might go on to more, and they might well have done if they'd made the right moves and made the right choices. Alex Pierce, if he hadn't got into that contract row, how good would he have been? Mm. We don't know. If Jem Karachan doesn't get crunched every time by Leeds, how good is he going to be? If we have the money to keep Federici, or we're in the Premier League, or Bournemouth get a big injury and he plays every week, how good is he going to be? It is difficult. I think sometimes you have to appreciate how far and how good we are at the moment. The very fact that we're talking and we're bringing through these players and signing these players for low fees and they go on to make so many championship games is an achievement in itself. Just because they don't crack the Premier League doesn't mean they're failures.
Yeah, and you think of James Henry, who's gone on to have a solid career at Championship League One level. I think it's a case of the sum of the parts, eh?
Oh, hey.
But it's a case of, I think generally, historically, Reading teams have been all about the team and not the individual as such. So you put Federici in the Reading team with the players around him who's come through the academy, but raised up through Reading with all these various players, and they're all put together, and it's very much a team ethos there, so it all works very well. But you take him out of that and throw him in another side, it doesn't quite work out so well. So
it is interesting how many players look back very fondly on their time with Reading more than any other club, especially from that 106 side.
Yeah, because at the time, one of the things was we recognised we couldn't compete financially with other clubs, so there was a real aim to make it a good place to be.
Mm. And that's something we're trying to do even today. I think that the Tones are trying to get that environment at the football club, and they're certainly doing it with the academy. Mm. Trying to make the academy one of the focal points, the new training ground as well. They're keen to build that up. So future is bright, I think. And that is the next question asked by Daniel Harrington. He says, with Samuel, Fosu, Cooper and Tishbola potentially in the mix next season, is the future bright for Reading?
You'd hope so. You know, Jack Stacey's not even mentioned, and you think of Liam Kelly, who's highly rated, Craig Tanner. There are a number of players. I mean, Aaron Cole, we mentioned. There are a number of players who are highly rated, and you think if they do get game time, and they don't necessarily have to go out on loan, you think, look at Jake Cooper. You think, okay, give him minutes and see what happens. I mean, Aaron Cole, when he played for Reading, didn't exactly look out of place. So he's just been a bit unlucky, really. But you do think, maybe, I mean, I have said, if we look safe this season and things look like that's it, they're petering out, you would like to think that McDermott would kind of start building for next season, this season, so that we go into next season with a bit of momentum.
Is your glass half full or half empty, John?
I think that one of the most significant things in Reading's history was getting Category 1 EPPP. That is so important, and it puts us on the par with the biggest clubs in terms of youth development. I think in terms of youth development, we've got it exactly right, and there's going to be a conveyor belt of players coming through, and we're just starting to see them. But, I mean, again, it's a question of whether they get game time and the patience. And we were talking about Jake Cooper playing and making mistakes. I mean, people have got to play and make mistakes, but the supporters have got to cut them some slack and cut the managers some slack when that's happening, because the end result is worth waiting for.
And that's why they send a lot of players out on loan, because quite simply, they want those players to make mistakes away from Reading.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't matter if they're making mistakes for Barnet or Gillingham or Fleetwood, because at the end of the day, that, you know, let's be fair, they're not Reading, so Reading fans aren't really going to care. So either you put up with their growing pains in front of your own eyes, or you put up with the fact that they're not going to be with your club and making mistakes elsewhere. So it's a tough one. So I'm sure even Gilfie made a few mistakes while he was out on Crewe. And Shrewsbury as well, did he go out on loan to? Or am I making that up? I know he was certainly at Crewe.
I don't remember Shrewsbury, but...
I'm sure, right. Yep. Sure. Again, the Tullestender universe is lamenting my unprofessional joke of low knowledge. If only Dave were here. Dave,
that's just what I was thinking. Yeah.
Dave would put much in my place. In fact, I tweeted on Saturday about, Boyd's playing against us. I swear he always scores great goals against Reading. Within about 5 seconds, David tapped me on the shoulder, because he literally stands behind me now, saying, no, only one goal against us. So he'll be back. Don't you worry. Right. And one final question in the mailbag from Hugh. He asks, who was the last player to wind you up as much as Gray did? I didn't think Gray wound me up that much, other than for the penalty, Steve.
No, well, I think, he kicked Hector. Hector held him off on the right touchline, I think, in the first half. And he kicked him. And that wound me up a bit. But that's another instance of poor refereeing. You know, he should have seen it and he should have dealt with that. But he didn't. Barton wound me up in the same game.
I was going to say, I'd say Barton wound me up much more than Gray did. John, who's a player from your memory that really always winds you up playing against?
It's one of two, and I can never remember which one. The Futcher brothers, Paul and Ron, from the late 70s, early 80s, something like that. There was one occasion when Martin Hicks and whoever the attacker of the brothers was, Martin Hicks was carried off on a stretcher with a broken jaw and shown the red card. Oof. As he departed, which is always good. They got in a real scrap. The next week, one was Barnsley, one was Oldham. The next home match, the brother played, and the South Bank crucified him, and he had no idea whatsoever. And if I can just add one other bit.
Go for it.
I discovered a little-known fact. There was a Futcher sister who is the mother of Danny Murphy. Who relegated us by scoring that goal at Portsmouth.
Ugh. So they had the last laugh, is what you're saying.
Oh, yes, yep.
No, that's not good. My nomination, Kevin Nolan. Oh, horrible.
Yes.
That game at Upton Park in the promotion season when he scored and he goes and gives it the middle finger to the Reading fans. So glad we held on to win that game. He's always... Well, I remember when him and Barton were in the same midfield at Newcastle.
Yes.
Awful. Brutal team, and Andy Carroll was in that team as well. That wasn't a very nice Newcastle team, was it?
No.
Trying to think of any others that always used to wire me up.
I think Matt Mills, but that's mostly just because we know him and he's an annoying person. Put nicely.
Yeah, he's not the most lovable character.
No. Or the most tactful in his hand signals.
Yeah. Neil Warnock, if I had to nominate a manager for the wind-up.
Yeah.
I think he's just beyond parody now. He's just a joke rather than somebody to get seriously upset about. He's more of a pantomime villain than anybody serious.
Yeah, 67 years old now and he's just taken on a championship relegation battle. Why don't you just settle for the easy life, Neil? You've got a cushy little gig on TalkSport. Just quietly ride off into the sun, so you don't need that.
He loves it, though. It gets his blood boiling.
Yeah. It gets my blood boiling.
Well, we'll be seeing him in 8 days' time as Rotherham come to visit, and really hope we can put one over him, because obviously he won on his last trip with QPR, did in Steve Clarke with that 1-0 win.
Yes.
But, and a really pathetic limp performance, but less of that said the better. Anyway, thank you very much to everyone who has got in touch with us. I said you can get in touch via at the Tarlist and on Twitter. Please use the TTE podcast hashtag. It will give you a much better chance of making the show. And to those who have emailed thetarlistender@gmail.com, and those that visited the Facebook page and have given us a like over at facebook.com Tarhurst.com/thetarhurstend. Let's wrap up this show now by putting up to that big FA Cup game on Saturday against West Brom.
The Tarhurst End Podcast.
Any other business?
Right, time for any other business. And just before we preview that game with West Brom at the Badeski on Saturday, just time for a quick update in the Tarhurst End Podcast Prediction League. And it is a very quick update this week because none of us got anything right. On Saturday against Burnley, all of us either predicted a Burnley win or a Reading win, so nobody gets the points except for our guest Rob Langham from the Two Unfortunates, who did correctly predict a 0-0 draw. So our guest got it right, but all of our regulars got it wrong. So it's as you were at the top, with Charles on top by 7 points from me and Johnny.
I'm a professional joke of predictions.
I am the reigning Prediction League champion, I'll have you know, Steve. Oh, sorry. And I'm still in this fight. I think Charles has used up all his luck for the season with his trip to the Emirates on Saturday. Sunday.
Yes.
I didn't read it out in the mailbag, but Ian Wilson, who is our devoted Leicester listener to this podcast, and to my knowledge, our only devoted Leicester listener, sent me a very nice tweet detailing his thoughts on the game that probably not very suitable for a family-friendly podcast, but... It went along the lines of, you'll know how I sent the Tarhurst End podcast in. I quite liked Arsenal. F them, F their players, F their fans, and importantly, F their fans. That bears repeating.
Yeah.
I felt so, so sorry for them on Sunday. Do you think, I know this is a Reading show, but we all give them time, because Ian gives us time. Do you think that's over for it? Do you think that's over for them, John?
I don't know. I mean, people have been saying it's over for them for about 10 weeks and it carries on. It's just a fairy story. So I'd like to think not.
Yeah, you would like it to continue. Yep. But equally, I'm kind of... My dad's a Tottenham fan, so I kind of want Tottenham to win it.
Yeah, my dad's got Tottenham leanings, as well as being a very devoted Royal, as you've heard on this show. But that still doesn't mean I want them to win. I want Leicester to win it. So thanks, Ian. We hope you do it. I can't tell if it's a good or a bad thing now that Leicester have got a couple of weeks off while everyone else is playing. I think it's a good thing. But
yeah, you'd think they'd get fresh legs and it's almost like a little reset, little holiday, winter break.
We'll see. You need something to dream about as a Championship fan, don't you? You need that ray of light to make you think that maybe that could be us with the right investments. You know, Leicester have got tie owners. We've got tie owners. Surely it's just a matter of time before we get into the Champions League, right? That's how it works. No?
Well, maybe. 106 points can happen. Champions League can happen.
Hey, look. If Leicester can get into the Champions League less than, what, just over a year after being doomed back to relegation, anything can happen. So, best of luck to you, Leicester. But may the best team win. I'm sure Charles Watts will have very different views when we speak on the Podcast Extra. Again, apologies, there was no Podcast Extra. I say it every week, and I know I sound like a broken record, but wacky circumstances happen. Charles, once again, had other commitments to deal with at the last minute, so we couldn't record a show. It is a small window for us, so we do our very best to get a show out on Friday. I'm not going to sit here and promise you, but keep your eye on that podcast feed, because all things being well, we will record. But right, let's move on to that West Brom game. It's basically what our season's boiled down to, gents, because the league's going nowhere. It's all of our eggs are in the FA Cup basket once again. We're in the fifth round for, what, the fourth time in the last 6 years. So can't complain about that. And if you had to pick out a tie for your last 16, I think this would probably be pretty high up the list. Confident heading to this one?
It's very winnable. Very winnable. You think, you know, West Brom are just a bit of an annoying team generally to watch and just to read news about. I mean, Tony Pulis, he's a good manager, but he does do your head in a bit. I don't know what the flat caps are all about. But they're a good side. They defend well, which might mean Reading struggle because Reading aren't traditionally very good at breaking down teams. But it's winnable. And there are, if we turn up and we hit form somehow, it's the FA Cup, it tends to happen like that, you know, we could win and go on to the next
one. Well, goals haven't been a problem in the FA Cup. We've scored 11 in three games, so there is that going for us. John, West Brom have struggled this season in the Cup. They've been taken to a replay by both Bristol City and Peterborough and only squeaked by Peterborough on penalties. I noticed they had to battle quite hard to get past Port Vale as well in the League Cup, so they're not exactly great at raising their game. They did beat Everton 1-0 in the Premier League at the weekend, though. Do you think they're there for the taking?
it could go either way. I mean, we just seem to suddenly turn it on when we're in the cup. So if we can do that again, yes. I just wish Everton had won and West Brom were a bit more in the bottom mire, so they had more things to think about. Because, yeah. I mean, they're just about safe now, so might be showing a bit more interest in the cup than they have previously.
They've not massively rotated their squad for the cup. I looked at their team against Peterborough. It's very similar to one that played Everton, so it's not really a case of, you know, putting out a second string. They are treating this cup competition seriously. Fingers crossed, when he can come out and do it. I've just got these visions of Saido Berahino when John Carew had done nothing for ages and popped up with that hat trick at the Medeski a few years ago for Villa. Speaking of Villa, I'm very much looking forward to our trip to Villa Park next season.
Yes.
But
just dig it in.
Yeah, look, like you said, it's a very winnable tie. It's a team who are not doing very well in the Premier League, who's, as you say, John, the FA Cup's not going to be their biggest priority. They're not in great away form. Their form in general in the last 10, they've only won three out of the last 10. And Reading get up for the cup. Reading have got players. If you match them up against West Brom, there's not a massive world of difference beyond extortionate transfer fees and huge wage packets. So we'll see how it goes. So Berahino for me is still the big threat. He's, now that his transfer things have settled for the summer, I've got visions of him really going on a tear to try and convince Tottenham that they want to spend that money on him for the summer.
Yeah, you can see it happening. He's a pacey striker as well, which we know Reading hate coming.
Yeah, well, Andre Gray very much had his fun, so I hope the same doesn't happen. So let's get on to predictions. These obviously don't count for the prediction league, but we'll get them anyway, so you can gloat on social media should you get them right. John, I'll let you go first. How do you see it going?
Too close to call, so I'll go for a 2-2 draw. I mean, I can see there being goals.
So exact copy of the 2010 tie.
That's right. And then a return trip with a trip to the Vine, which is the best football pub in the country.
There you go. Advice.
Nice tip there.
Steve?
I'm going to go 1-0 to Reading. Just because neither team really scores. I know it's the cup. And that it could be goals in it. But I'm thinking,
I know it's the cup, and I know there could be goals in it. You've really nailed your colours to the mast there, Steve. There might be goals.
There might be goals, but okay.
There might or there might not. Are you Johnny Williams in disguise?
No, I'm 1-0 to Reading. Another clean sheet would be nice.
I'm going to go on the draw front as well. I think this will be a 1-1, but I do think we'll win the replay. I think we're better. I think that'll be where we end our away day hoodoo, so you have been warned. At least we've not all predicted positives. That's where it usually all goes wrong. So I won't be getting the predictions of the other guys because it doesn't count for the league. But we will hopefully, as mentioned, hear from Charles Watts before the end of the week to get all the very latest team news. There are doubts hanging over Danny Williams and Matty Vidra, both missing the game on Saturday. So we'll catch up with how they're getting on and if we can expect to see them. But guys, thank you very much indeed for joining me. It's been a very nice show.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah,
very nice live show. As mentioned earlier, please go check out the Sum of the Parts. Again, you'll be able to find the link attached to the episode of this show on thetarlesden.com. Very much encourage you to go and check it out. I said, if you've got any questions whatsoever, please get in touch with John at URS1871. That's with two Zs on Twitter. And please do check out the Tarless End this week. As mentioned, we have got our State of Reading series. One of our assistant editors, Will, has been working very hard to put it all together. It's going to have several different voices, and we very much want you all to be a part of it and to have your say. Said part one is on the identity ambition. We've got a look at the club's transfer policy. I'm going to be taking a look at the academy. We've got lots of other bits and pieces as well. And also, waiting in the wings for the tarlessend.com. Speaking of the 106 point team, Matt Williams is going to be writing out what happened next to the 106 team. So having a look at what happened to the players that once they left. So if you've ever wondered what happened to Eric Abina and John Halls, well, I've given that one away, you'll be able to check those out. So keep an eye on that for next week, and also plenty your own match report and ratings for the Burnley game.
Yes.
If you want to have your say on Oliver Norwood.
If you want to back me up on this, go ahead, please.
But yes, guys, thank you very much for joining me. And the only thing to say is, come on, Eagles. It's funny how the crowds always leave a trail. Funny how the crowds always leave a trail. It's funny how they always leave a trail. You smile, you smile. Funny how the crowds always leave a trail.
Tarlhurst End Podcast.
Read the blog
on thetarlhurstend.com.